today.
I was just kidding.
Roberts versus the THE Insurance Company, 14 AP 1508. Are you prepared to begin? Please do.
Singing Happy Holidays, attorneys Tim Knurr and Phil George is appearing on behalf of the petitioners and plaintiffs, Dave and Patty Roberts, who are present in court this morning. It seems like yesterday I was here arguing against Section 89380 discretionary immunity in Legui versus City of Racine. Now I'm here some 16 months later arguing against 89552 recreational immunity. Apparently, defeating immunity has been my cause before this court. As I see it, the Roberts are here today asking this court to reinstate their claim against Sundog Balloon Company and its owners because we believe in this particular case the recreational immunity statute has been applied beyond its intended scope. And as I see the intended scope of the recreational immunity statute as stated both in the legislative intent and as articulated by this court, it's grounded in the assumption or the assertion that as public lands began to decrease and access to public lands began to decrease, they wanted to create a law that would encourage private landowners and other landowners to open up their land to recreational users without the fear of being sued. It's like, hey, if I want to come and hike on your property, I'm going to let you do that, but I don't want the fear of being sued. But as I look at the intent of this statute, I truly believe that the intent was focusing on conditions associated with the land or the maintenance of the land, not negligent acts unassociated with the condition of the land.
Counsel, one background question. I invite your opposing counsel to respond when he has the opportunity. Looking, preparing for this case, we in our chambers have been unable to find a case where immunity has been granted where the user or occupier is 3 degrees of separation away from the actual owner. Now, I'm not quite sure where that fits in the overall picture of things, but it certainly was an item of interest for me. For the very reason, what sparks that recollection is you reminding us all of what the original intent behind the recreational use immunity statute was, which is, as you say, to encourage private landowners to allow. So I wonder if you, and then again, your opposing counsel, when it's his turn to speak, have been able to find any cases where immunity has been granted where the occupier has been more than 1 degree of separation from the actual owner?
The answer to that question, I have every case cited right here, and I think the answer to that question is no. I can't find one that has somebody removed that far out.
How, if at all, should that fit in with our analysis? I say how, if at all, should that fit in with our analysis?
I think it should fit in this way, in the sense that the statute was intended to apply to owners, and owners were defined as occupiers. And then from there, under the Snow Eagles case, it somehow got extended to users, that a user can now become an owner. But under Snow Eagles, they also said there's a degree of permanence. So to answer your question, I think the way you look at it is, let's go back to the original intent, which is to have the somebody who has the ability and permission to open up their lands to somebody, that's the person we want to protect in this case, not the person who goes upon the land with the permission of that person to use the land on a very, very temporary basis.
Or I guess said another way, and again, I invite your opposing counsel to respond to this too. You say that's the person we want to provide immunity to. I suppose the legislature would have said that's the person that we want to encourage to share their resources with those less fortunate.
Well,
if we provide immunity.
I'd actually prefer to hear his response, if he has one, Justice Abrahamson.
And I think that's...
No problem.
You're more than gracious.
Yeah. I think that specific intent was stated by the legislature and cited by this court when you cite the legislative intent of what is the intent of this body as to what we want to do. You don't see any language within the legislative history or in the cases cited by this court or the Court of Appeals where there seems to be an extent to extend it beyond the person who has the ability to give permission for you to use their property. In this particular case, Sundog would have absolutely no ability to give anybody permission to use those grounds at Beaver Dam. And I just don't think that they intended to extend that type of immunity to those people who, like you say, are so removed. But somewhere along the line, we've gotten from owner to be an occupier to be a user. And I've cited the situations where I think that would lead to an absurd result. And even though you found immunity in the Irvin case way back when, you did say that this statute should not be construed to lead to absurd results. And I gave you a laundry list of situations where if you simply have it as a user of the property, the drunken snowmobiler who's using the state's trail that runs into somebody and kills them, if you accept the proposition and the arguments of the Court of Appeals in its decision and the trial court in this case, that person would be immune because he's using the property and engaged in a recreational activity. So I think your point is well taken. If you scale it back to what really was the intent here, to encourage landowners to open up the use of their land to recreational users, then I think you can scale it back to what was meant for immunity in this particular case.
But you never sued the owner, did you?
No.
And no matter how this case comes down, the owner is protected in the way.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I can't think of a scenario where in this case we could have sued, under what theory would we sue the Conservation Club that opened up this particular piece of property for them to do this tethered balloon event? They clearly were the owner of the property. They clearly, somebody was engaged in a recreational activity.
Well, this is a slight addition to what you just said. The Conservationalist Association of Beaver Dam did not open it up to Sundog to do a tethered. They opened it up to the intermediary, the Green Valley, I think.
Correct.
Okay.
Who then invited, because
right.
They were friends, you know, he said, hey, my buddy says, I've got this balloon. Why don't I show up and let people ride in it for nothing in hopes of raising some money, that you raise some money. So, again, yeah, it is removed that way out.
What is your best case for saying occupy doesn't mean this temporary kind of using the property?
My best case would be this court's decision in Linville and then the Doan case, which basically says, look, even though we determine that an occupier is somebody who doesn't necessarily have legal title or dominion over the property, both of those cases, and even in Snow Eagles, if you go back to the original case, which I think kind of started the problem with you, they asserted that there has to be some degree of permanence associated with the use of that land.
If we didn't rule in your favor today, what kind of protections would exist for people who, you know, I'm thinking of, for example, have a birthday party at your house and you have one of those bouncy, you know, things come onto the property? Could they set that up any way they want and it doesn't really matter because so long as that's touching the ground, they would have recreational immunity? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, part of personal injury law is making sure people are properly protected. Where would the protection be for anyone if we were to allow this kind of temporary use of a property constitute being an occupant?
Yeah, I'm sorry. In that particular case, you could probably use the specific invitation exception found in 895.52 because there is that provision that says there is no immunity if you specifically and explicitly invite somebody onto your property. The immunity does not extend. So we could have that protection that way. But I can think of a myriad of other situations very much like that where there's just a general invitation to people to come to the church fair.
That's right.
And they set up the bouncy thing, and they're clearly engaged in a recreational activity. And I don't believe it should go to negligent acts not associated with the condition of the land or the maintenance of the land. And I know this court asked that when we came up here today that we address the user versus occupier versus owner. That was one of the specific issues that we were asked to address. And I have to admit, at the trial court level and all the way through, we just kind of went through assuming that, well, they were users. And, you know, it's a very cogent point that, hey, wait a minute, you're right. There is a degree of permanence associated with you to be, and I think.
What's the degree?
Well, you know, there you go.
One day fare?
I knew that question would be coming, and it's like, well, where do you draw that line?
Right. And it is line drawing. Once you say there's a difference between a user and an occupier, and a degree of permanence.
Here's the way I kind of look at it. If you take a look at some of the cases, like, for instance, the people who set up the case where they set up the tents, and they have games of chance, and they invite 2,000 people, and they have wood chips on the ice, and, you know, you are exerting a certain amount of control over that what?
Who is you? You are exerting a degree
the
of
perk. Control. In that particular case, it was the Lions Club, I think, that was...
They didn't own the land.
They did not own the land.
You have to be careful. You have to be careful because own is defined to mean occupier. Ordinary language, own means you have title. But that's not what own means here, right?
Correct.
Okay.
By
so,
statute, it doesn't, by so, definition.
Right. So who owned the land?
In that particular case, I think the city owned it and allowed them to...
And the city allowed the Lions to have...
Correct.
An event. How long did the event last?
In that particular case, it was one day.
All right. And who was sued? Lions?
The Lions Club was sued, and this court determined that there would not be recreational immunity, not because they weren't an owner, not because they weren't a user, but because illegal games of chance and gambling went on. The problems with the cases, as I see them...
Well, don't you have any cases where you had a one-day or two-day event and there was immunity?
The only ones that I can think of are the fair cases, and those all seem to be more than one-day cases.
3 days? I'm trying to find out what is a degree of permanence.
A degree of permanence to me is that you are exercising some control over who comes and goes from your event in the sense of, with regard to a fair, perhaps you charge admission, perhaps you have a gate. It's intended to be people who are exercising something more than, I say, a transient. Actually, you're not really doing anything to the exclusion of anybody else, more like the fishing boat. In Doan, where, you know, the ice shanty was akin to a fishing boat where it's on a part of a lake. I guess what I'm looking for, and I'm not articulating it very well, is some degree of control to the exclusion of others for a period of time. It could be a day. It could be 2 days. Could it be 6 hours? I don't know.
Usually.
To say something, you started to say the problem with these cases, and then Justice Abrahamson asked you a question. I'm interested in knowing, after you've obviously had a chance to reflect on them, what were you about to say?
I was about to say that when I took a look at each and every one of these cases, none of these cases, other than Doan, really looked at the quality and quantity of the contacts to the land.
To the land, right.
I mean, one was a church group. You know, the one where the WENA, which is the church group that was released because they were a sponsor, you know, they didn't really look at whether the church group should be considered an owner simply because they're the ones who rented out the park for their church to have an impromptu softball game. But you look at each and every one of these cases, they seem to be decided on something other than an examination by any court of the quality and extent of the contact to the land.
Such as what? Sympathy?
I'm sorry, what?
Such as what? You said they seem to be decided on something other than the nature and quality of the contact to the land. And I supplied one potential answer, which is sympathy. But I don't know if that's where you were going.
Here they are. Well, if you take a look down and you just go down the line, you take a look at Hall versus Turtle Club. Turtle Lake's Lions Club. Plaintiff stepped into a hole on a village park during sponsored fair by the Turtles. Like, whether Lions Club was a landowner. Yes, because they had actual use of the property. In Hall versus Turtle, the Court of Appeals said, yeah, we're finding them to be an owner because they have actual use of the property. There was no analysis.
Well, that's where my question is going, to the next step. Why do you think that the original language of the statute has been so extended to get away from the quality, the nature, and the properties, so to speak, of the land?
My argument would be is that there's also follow-up language in just about every case that talks about how this statute is to be liberally construed to extend immunity to a landowner. And I think in this particular case, in our case, it was very, very liberally construed to, like you say, go to somebody who's 3 degrees removed from the land, who was there for but a couple of hours and was going to leave.
Do you think you'd be facing the same challenge if this were a typical hot air balloon case where they're not tethered at all to one specific parcel of land, and instead they took their ride and they landed in a field, in the person's field, they don't know that the hot air balloon's landing there, they just happened to land, and there was something that you're alleging was done wrong with respect to that balloon ride and that landing. Do you think in that circumstance, and I'll ask you to respond when it's your chance, do you think in that circumstance the balloon company could claim recreational immunity based upon landing on some landowner's land somewhere at some point in time?
No, I don't think they should. I don't, between you and I don't think there's any difference between this case and that case.
That's what I'm asking you.
I don't think there's any difference whatsoever. I think Attorney Ward Richter took a flyer when he, you know, affirmed.
No pun intended.
You know, I affirmed, no pun intended, you're right. When he affirmatively alleged recreational immunity and got the court to grant it. But if you kind of go back to my argument too, the whole determining whether or not somebody is or isn't an owner doesn't necessarily answer the question about whether or not recreational immunity should be extended in this case. And let me give you an example. Deer hunting with my father on his land, no question, he owns it. He's got multiple permanent deer stands. I'm not talking about the things you chain up. I'm talking about you build structures on the land. But we're surrounded by hunters, okay? He's clearly an owner. He clearly would be involved in a recreational immunity. What if he accidentally shot one of those hunters on an adjoining piece of land? Whether or not he's an owner falls by the wayside. He clearly is an owner. He's clearly engaged in a recreational activity. That's why I keep going back to my argument is that, as in Doyne and as you said in Linville, this statute is not directed at negligent activity or conduct of a person that is unassociated with the condition of the land or the maintenance of the land. Because theoretically, in my father's situation, if he shot somebody, he would be entitled to immunity because he clearly is an owner on his land in a structure engaging in a recreational activity. But I don't think anybody in the legislature or anybody on this court would say that that's a legitimate application of the statute, because that leads to an absurd result, just like you ruled in Linville.
What difference does it make if it's on the structure or if he's walking on the land?
None. The addition of
the structure is not important because you got land that's owned here, and property is defined as real property and structures, right?
Correct.
So
and
that's different than the boat incident or the shanty incident, because there
exactly.
You didn't have property.
Exactly, that's correct.
Right.
The fact that I mentioned a deer stand in a structure is irrelevant. He could be walking and shoot the deer, but then that would lead to an absurd result of him being...
But if there's a hole in the ground and a deer hunter falls in and shoots himself when the gun goes off, Is your father liable?
If he steps in a hole and the gun goes off, boy, that's a law school exam question right there.
I think that's a simple one.
Well, it's in the situation, if
there's an owner, there's a condition of the property, he has no responsibility to keep that property in good condition. He has no responsibility to fill holes, right?
Correct.
And so he has immunity.
It's tough to argue that he doesn't, because
that's right.
What happened is tied back to everything that happened. It can be tied back to a problem or a condition with the land
right.
that mm-hmm. caused the injury.
That's right.
But there again, that's an easy distinction to make.
That's right.
Because
which has nothing to do with structure.
Agreed.
All right. Now, this
I shouldn't
court.
Have even used the term structure. It's like I met.
It's very difficult to avoid using terms which don't have other meanings in this case.
True.
The concept that it had to be on a structure.
That was. I just simply put that in there as it. He met all three criteria.
It's for the deer hunters involved.
Right.
Okay.
But
now here's my question to you. In these cases, we've had a run, pun intended, of recreational immunity. We haven't had one for a long time, but we got a lot of them, right?
Yes.
In fact, probably if you added them up and categorized it, we have more recreational immunity cases than maybe any other small category of cases. And this court has said to the legislature, this statute is unintelligible and is extraordinarily difficult to apply in the variety of fact situations we see. The court has said that, right?
I'm sorry, what?
The court has said
yes.
that. And the court has said to the legislature, please repair this statute, right?
Correct.
And now we have another case that raises another series of questions. Why shouldn't we just say that this statute is totally incomprehensible, totally difficult to apply, and we're not going to do that, and you win?
you can sit down.
You like the last sentence, I'm sure of that.
Prosser has been having a
well,
question
you want
for the last
to answer my question,
several minutes.
I want to know why isn't that a good argument?
I'll bet he's going to say he should win.
Well, why isn't that a good argument? Well, I mean, all joking aside.
Yeah, I'm not joking. I mean that seriously.
I know you do. And I view this as, I know this court has rejected it, but I go back to the constitutional right to have, as Justice said, the constitutional right to be a remedy for every wrong. This is a statute that takes that away. Its intended purpose was to open up land. I think that's a misguided intent because, quite frankly, other than snowmobilers, I don't know about you, but how many people, you go knock on somebody's door and say, can I go hike on your 100 acres? It's a non-reality out there of private property owners refusing to open their land because they're potentially liable. But I think the whole thing, I mean, honestly, I abhor immunity. I think our Constitution in Article 2, Section 9 specifically says you're entitled to a remedy for every wrong. So
I think it's 1-9.
1-9, you're right.
Justice Prosser is trying to ask a
you're
question.
Right. Thank you.
Even if the entire statute were thrown out, I think you still have to deal with the release that was prepared by Sundog. Why don't you address that?
Yes. With regard to the release, first and foremost, there was no negotiating. There's no equal bargaining. They were standing in line, and they were simply said, if you want to ride this balloon, you have to sign this particular document. And in this that's in the record, it specifically talks about all the risks explained to me in the pre-flight meeting. There's no pre-flight meeting. There was nothing. It's a bunch of people showed up at these grounds. They put up a static display, simply said, you want to ride this, you have to sign it. There's no discussion about what are the dangers associated with standing and watching a balloon event. There was no discussion at all. There was no bargaining that went on. They want to, the release language is incredibly broad. It releases them for everything under the sun, which this court has said, no, we don't go along with those. Those are invalid. I think for every reason that this court has invalidated an exculpatory release applies to this particular case. And you got to keep in mind this contention that it was really, her husband was standing right next to her in the line, and he didn't sign a release. Would you like me to continue? The red light is on.
Yeah, finish your answer.
He wasn't required to sign the release, and the fact of the matter is she hadn't even given the release back. This release was found on the ground blowing in the wind after she was injured. She at any time could have decided to walk away, and there's no dispute she hadn't given it back to him, hadn't even really decided whether she was going to ride this balloon. So I think for all the reasons cited in my brief that this has no validity whatsoever to it.
Thank you.
Well, it is a recreational activity to be involved in a balloon like this. There is no charge. I think it's self-evident there are certain dangers. So what would you say would be necessary in your mind to have a valid release?
In a situation like this where you're simply inviting people to a charitable event at a last minute, I don't think you could ever come up with a particular release. When part of the thing was, you got to remember, they said, we set up a static display just in case we couldn't do the thing, so people could just come and look at the basket. In a situation like this where your intent is to have people just kind of wander around and maybe look at it, with their only intent is to watch the balloon go up and down, I don't think you could ever possibly come up with a valid exculpatory release that could release you from an act like this. I mean, where in the world would they ever have the expectation that these people weren't paying attention to the fact that a storm front was coming in? You know, one of the funny things, not to digress too much, we've got some beautiful pictures of the event where it shows this beautiful green grass, the beautiful cornfield, the beautiful blue sky, and in the background, there's the beautiful storm front coming in. You can literally see it. And my point is, who would these, you know, who would ever expect that they're going to be released from somebody going and participating in a tethered balloon event in the face of what it should have been a known gust front?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is David Ress. I represent the respondents in this case, Carrie and Jody Hansen, Sundog Ballooning, and its insurance company. I'll refer to that group as the Hansons. We're here today to ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and the trial court and find that the recreational immunity statute applies to the Hansons.
How long do you have to be an occupant to receive recreational immunity? Or are you saying anytime you touch the land and do anything on it, you receive the immunity of the landowner?
I don't think that there's a time requirement to an occupation.
So when would there ever be liability?
When would there ever be liability under the statute? Well, the statute itself, I think the petitioners painted as this overly broad, unwieldy statute, but there are exceptions in there that really narrow the application of the statute.
Well, let me give you an example.
Sure.
Hot air balloon, we live on a farm. Hot air balloon comes in and decides to land there. They crash because they did a bunch of things wrong and didn't keep their balloon safe, and you know, it just breaks and it's a terrible event. They get our immunity because we're landowners and they touched our land?
Not on that basis alone. Again, if that operator or owner of the balloon ride accepted money for that ride, that's one of the exceptions in the statute. This isn't intended to immunize for-profit owners.
So if you do it for free, you don't have to be safe?
Well, that's just one of the exceptions. If you, if you're opening up your property for recreational use and you avoid all the exceptions in the statute, then yes, you're immunized.
The landowner, I get that part of it. But the people who come on to your land, they receive the benefit of the landowner's immunity merely because they've offered it for free and they're there for some period of time, even if it's really short.
It's possible. I mean, there's so many different facts that could go into that, but the key word in the statute is owner. An owner is defined as more than just somebody who owns the real property. It's defined as an owner, an occupier, or a lessee.
I'll just lay it out there. To me, you have an uphill battle here. So I need you to give me the best case you have for someone temporarily being on the property and more of a user, and how that is the same thing as being an occupant.
Sure.
Occupying the property.
Sure.
Shortest duration case where they got the recreational immunity.
The Hall case, Hall v. Turtle Lake Lions Club. There, it's a defendant hosting a one-day fair. They have permission to use that property, and they put it to actual use. And occupy is not defined by the statute, but what Hall does is it looks to the Seventh Circuit Smith case, and it states that an occupant is something less than an owner. The legislator included owner and occupiers. They can't mean the same thing. And what Hall says is that an occupier is someone who is more transient than an owner. So there is a temporary nature to occupancy. Now, occupancy could take on a longer role, but it's not required by this actual use principle of Hall.
So I'm back to, are there any limits to your argument as to when, if it's, there's no duration in time to receive the status of essentially a landowner, because the cases talk in terms of landowner, and I get how an occupant could be a landowner. You could lease it, you could have a variety of different things where you're not the owner, but you're an occupant. But that sort of connotes that you have some sort of ability to control what's going on the property, to me. So are there any limits to when someone is or isn't an occupant?
Yes. Permission and possession. Those are the two factors that go to whether there is occupancy. One, in all these cases in which a defendant is found to have occupied land, they've had permission from the actual owner to do so. The second factor, possession. The petitioner just moments ago stated or talked about the same concept. The possession requires an actual use of the land to the extent that the occupier is using it to the exclusion of others.
So if you have permission and possession, you can be as unsafe as you want to be, and you're going to receive immunity.
So long as the exceptions are met, again, this is a very fact-intensive statute, but if you have permission and possession, you qualify as an occupier of real property and therefore are granted the immunities in the statute.
I'm not quite clear on how that response squares with what we said in Doan, and I know you're familiar with it, and it's the sentence, however, occupy as used in 895.52 has been defined by this court as requiring a degree of permanence as opposed to mere use. Now let's just for the sake of conversation say that this court may use this case as an opportunity to clarify that language, something we do quite often. How would you suggest we clarify? Now, I understand your response to Justice Eagler, permission and possession, but I don't see how that helps us clarify the requirement of a degree of permanence.
Sure. In Doan, the court uses that phrase, a degree of permanence, and I don't think that phrase is a departure from what the Hall case held. If we look at Doan, in fact, the court cites to Hall specifically when it uses the phrase a degree of permanence. If we read Hall, you won't find that phrase in Hall. So I think what the court is doing is perhaps putting a finer point or just characterizing the actual use concept in a different way. And really implicit in actual use is a degree of possession. It goes to that possession factor that I just stated. So, for example, if I were to walk out of here, go into a city park, Sure, I'm using the park as I'm walking across it, but I'm not getting ownership with each and every step I'm taking.
But let's stick with Doan for a second.
Sure.
Let's stick with the facts there, the ice shanty. And the question there was whether the person who was using the ice shanty was an occupier or a user. And that's the context in which the court said, whether it relied on a different case correctly or not, that's the rule that emerges from Doan, that there is a, let's say again, for the purpose of conversation, that there are members of the bench who believe that to occupy requires a degree of permanency. How would you suggest we clarify that?
I don't necessarily disagree that a degree of permanence is required. And
you
I
do not
say that not, I do not necessarily disagree that a degree of permanence is required.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back again to the Hall case. I think those two cases are not inconsistent. In Doan, the owner of the shanty was not an owner of the land because, one, they didn't have that permission. They didn't have special permission from the state to use that specific portion of the lake. They were simply using the lake at that time. They weren't exerting control over that to the exclusion of others. They didn't have the right to do that.
Right.
And it's the Doan court also compared the shanty to a fishing boat. Yeah. We can all picture a lake in Wisconsin in the summer with populated by fishing boats. Certainly the statute doesn't say that each and every one of those boat owners or operators are owners under the statute. They're just merely using it. So to get beyond a mere use and to get to actual use or a degree of permanence possession, we look at the nature and the characteristics of what the the occupier was doing on that day. And if we look here, we can see there was definitely possession. The Hansons exerted possession over the land. This is more than just a balloon floating over a piece of land. This was a tethered ride. It was a basket, a blower, a balloon, all joined together and attached. There are then
trees in a truck, I think.
Exactly.
Well, and then when I hear that, I think of a boat, a fishing boat, that would be tethered by means of an anchor to the bed of a lake. So does that convert our Sunday fisherman to an occupier? I mean, they're both tethered at one. See what I mean? See my point?
That's I do. But the difference there is there isn't that permission component. We have permission and possession. The fisherman certainly has the right to use the waters of the state, as we all do.
Well, let's say it's a private lake. There are private lakes in the state, and the owner grants any one of us permission to go catch a bunch of bluegills or sunnies or whatever, and we're out there. We tether our boat because that's where they are. That's where I think you're having a little bit of difficulty, and I won't interrupt you again. Please tell me how that's different from the standpoint of creating a degree of permanency.
I think your scenario there is slightly different than what happened in Doan.
Okay.
And it's different because of those two components. So that's my response to you, Your Honor, is the permission possession. That's what goes to telling us whether there is a degree of permanence to the occupation. So if someone is given specific permission to occupy a piece of land or a piece of lake by the owner, and then they actually use that permission, they exert control over it, and they exert that control to the exclusion of others, that's where we get the degree of permanence. That's where we get the actual use concept stated in Hall.
Okay, I understand.
Could I ask, did Beaver Dam conservationists give permission? Did they give permission to Sundog ballooning?
It's not in the record, Your Honor. I'm not aware if the conservation club gave a specific permission to the owners. I do know, and I believe it's undisputed here, that the Hansons were operating with permission from the charity event. The charity event indeed had permission to run the event on the gun club land, and in turn the Hansons had permission to operate their ride. Now, I can't find in the record whether the conservation club specifically spoke to the Hansons and gave them a specific permission, but I think implicit in the Hansons' use that day, consistent with the charity event, they did have permission from the owner. And as a result of that permission, the Hansons have the two factors that I think we can take from these Occupy cases. They had permission. They had possession. In addition to the ropes actually tying the ride to the land, the Hansons literally flagged off the land. They're literally marking their territory. They're saying, this is our land. They're using that land that day to the exclusion of others. This is not the type of operation where somebody could come over and ask the Hansons to move 20 feet over. This was a significant operation. They had to set up the balloon. They had to tie it to the ground. They flagged it off. They set up a display, a sign-up table. Lines were formed. So they exerted actual use of the property. They took full possession of it, and they took that possession to the exclusion of others.
The entire property?
No, the portion on which their ride was located.
So where was she hit?
She was hit waiting in line for the balloon.
How do we know how big their portion was?
I don't have an exact measurement for you, but the area was flagged off. So the area in which the riders are waiting for the balloon would be the Hansons' property.
Does the record disclose that, in fact, the impact took place within the staked-out territory? My understanding is the facts are that people saw the problem and then they started logically running away from it. Is it in the record that it happened within the staked-out area?
We don't have a specific X marks the spot kind of area, but this was a very fast-moving incident. The balloon comes down, the rope snaps, the wind pushes it across the land. So Ms. Roberts was waiting in line for the ride at the time.
I thought she was running, and she went back because she didn't see her son. She was concerned about her son and started running back. So anyway, I just don't know whether the impact itself took place. And apparent, I don't think you do either from your answer.
It's not apparent in the record specifically the location. I believe it did occur on the Hansons' land because she was waiting in line, and the relatively quick nature of the incident. I don't think it would have given enough time for Ms. Roberts to exit the land in which the Hansons were using.
I don't know. I think even I could move pretty fast if I saw it. Balloon basket moving towards me. The record isn't clear, right?
The record does not reflect as to the exact location of where the impact occurred in relation to the flagged off.
Counsel, I want to return to the issue of permanency. Your response was that you did not, it was the double negative, in other words, meaning that you agreed there had to be some degree of permanency. You indicated that the Hall case, which I have not recently read, did not have any reference to the language degree of permanency. Is that correct?
No. What I was just saying is that the Hall case doesn't use that phrase. A degree of permanency.
Okay, doesn't use that phrase. Okay.
Correct.
And it cited the Smith case. Hall cited Smith. Doan said C. Hall, yeah, citing Smith. Now, Smith is a Seventh Circuit, but pre the statute, as I recall. So we are riding on a sentence in Doan that is a C cite to Hall, citing a federal case that predates interpretation of the statute. Nevertheless, you indicate there is a degree of sense in attempting to add this component of degree of permanency. That's your position. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's say St. Anne's had a parish picnic, and it lasted not 3 days, but only one day on Sunday. Is that a degree of permanency? Let's try to find what are those contours.
Yes, it could be. It's going to depend on the nature of which they took possession. But if their possession was consistent with what the Turtle Lake Lions Club did in Hall, what our clients did here, in that they set up their event, they are marking off their territory, they're using that particular land to the exclusion of others, then yes, I think one day is enough. I think setting a time limit to occupation isn't a very workable solution.
So duration isn't the answer.
Okay. Not in the sense that 5 hours equals occupancy and 4 hours doesn't.
Well, then what does degree of permanency mean?
the character of the possession at the time. Are they possessing that land to the exclusion of others, and are they doing so based on a specific permission? That is, I think, the better focus rather than saying 4 hours, no, 5 hours, yes. And I think that's a better solution because I think you would get very drastic decisions on this case. And I'm not sure how you pick a time frame. I'm not sure how you pick a specific time where occupancy is like a switch and now it's on. So I think looking at the characteristics of the possession, was it to the exclusion of others? Were they using that land pursuant to a permission by the owner? That's what the focus should be on determining a degree of permanence.
In Hall, though, he was walking away to use the restroom. So given your analogy, he wasn't within the staked out area. He was just on fair grounds. So how do you reconcile that with your argument? What I heard you say earlier was this happened within the staked out grounds of this hot air balloon ride, and so we had the control over that area, and that's why we received recreational immunity. Hall, I think, dealt with that because fair activities were on the entirety of the fair, that there was recreational immunity, even though he wasn't in one specific area, he was somewhere on the fair grounds. So why isn't your argument, I would have thought under Hall you'd be arguing the whole place is covered. So if our balloon flew over to the other side of the area, we'd still be covered because this parcel was ours to use for this. But I heard you say, no, it's not really the whole area, it's just the staked out area.
Well, let me clarify. It's the area in which the balloon needed space was flagged off. There's a waiting area, a line that people were waiting into to ride the ride. The flags were giving the ride, the tethered ride, the space it needed to operate. So my point was, and if I made it, if I wasn't very clear, is that the land in which the Hansons were using included the portion of the balloon ride, the flagged off area, and the line, so to speak, wherever the crowd was congregating and forming that line. That was the operation. So the flags were the Hansons marking off the specific territory for the balloon to give it space.
What's your best support for parceling it out like that?
Is the statute. The statute refers to occupiers. Owners of property are granted immunity. An owner is someone who occupies the land. They were occupying the portion on which they were operating their ride. The cases, there isn't a case that fits the facts of this case. It's a pretty unique case in the sense that there's a lot of moving parts here. But the Hall case, even if we look to the Koski case, there it's a 4th of July fireworks show. The immunity statute's not ultimately applied, but the court does find that the defendant, Alliance Club, is an owner because they're using the property. They have permission. They're using the land. That's a very temporary, less than one day event. In fact, the injury occurs on the 4th of July while the setup is happening for the night's festivities. So again, there it's on the property in which the defendant is occupying the land. So what my argument is that the Hansons here were occupying all of the land they needed to use their balloon operation.
So if the balloon were cut loose somehow and all the tethers were removed and it went to a different area of this event, then they'd be liable? Because it wasn't staked off? It injured someone in an area that wasn't staked off because they weren't occupying that?
Correct. If the balloon is drifting over into a farmer's field, I think that takes away the occupancy component.
No, I'm talking still in the same area of the event, but not in the staked off area. Then you're saying you're liable?
I'm saying that, I'm not sure they're liable because of ownership under a second tract in which I discussed in my brief, and that's owner of property, property being the structure. But I'm not here today to say that the Hansons occupied every square inch of the gun club. I don't think that's borne out in the facts. They didn't. They occupied the portion on which the ride, the tethered ride, was located, including...
Last time, I'll try the same thing.
Sure.
What's your best case for parceling off occupancy?
Well, I think all of these cases are. The Turtle Lake Lions Club, they're using a portion of the land. Wena, via Atlantic Mutual. There it's a church who's using a city softball diamond. The injury occurs on the diamond. They're occupying the softball diamond. These cases, it doesn't, just because a city grants occupancy of a park doesn't mean that owner becomes an owner under every single piece of land owned by the city. The courts look to the actual land being used by the owner of property. And I believe the Hansons are also owners under a second path to ownership under the statute. And again, the terms owner and property are important here. Property is defined as real property, buildings and structures and improvements thereon. So you can be an owner of a structure and qualify as an owner under the statute. And we have some very direct guidance here from this court, the Peterson case. There we have a defendant who has a relative that allows him to use land for hunting. This defendant takes a wood platform, puts it up against a tree, and wraps a chain around it. He puts a ladder up to that tree to gain access to the platform.
That was the grandson who did it, right? The grandson had put it up there. The user had climbed the tree to the pre-existing stand. The user had not placed the stand. That's my recollection of
the fact.
The grandparents owned it, gave permission to the grandson. Grandson invited friend. Friend was out, found the tree with the old school stand.
Yes.
Kind I will not use. But so my point is, he didn't put it there. It was there. The injured party found it there.
The injured party did not put it there. The defendant did.
Right.
The defendant was the owner of the structure. The defendant took the makeshift wood platform, cinched it to the tree. That's the structure.
Does the case say when it was affixed to the tree?
There's not a specific date, but it says, I believe it was over a year from the date of the injury to...
Right, because in my observations, my experiences, those are the kind of stands that people tend to leave. They don't just move them around. But anyway, I wanted to know if my recollection was correct.
Correct. It's not the landowner's structure.
So my point is, you want us to draw one inference, but one of the inferences possible from that case is that structure had a degree of permanence to it.
Well, the analysis of structure is not related to the degree of permanence analysis.
It may or may not.
Currently it is not. There is no case law that states a degree of permanence is necessary for a structure. And what the Peterson court held there, it looked at two different dictionaries to help define what structure means. It's not defined by the statute. And they ultimately held this makeshift tree stand was a structure because, and I quote, it was constructed, built, or put together in a particular way and made up of parts joined together.
Well, and with all due respect to that language, when I read it, I thought, what wouldn't qualify as a structure? That's what wouldn't qualify as a structure. So,
well, it's not just necessarily what qualifies as a structure, but what qualifies under the rest of the statute then. So we're looking at what defines a structure under the statute and whether immunity applies then to the owner of the structure subject to the exceptions listed in the statute.
So under that, if the invitee, the grandson's friend, had brought his own piece of wood, brought his own chain, And under that, then you would say that the case law would compel us to find immunity?
Immunity for the landowner?
Yes.
Yes, the landowner here didn't actually construct the structure. So the landowner is allowing these people to use their land. They're opening up their land for use. So the landowner... wasn't really involved in this case. It was the person who erected the structure.
My point is, it would have been the grandson, under this scenario, my hypothetical, it would have been the grandson's friend.
Yes.
Who brought his own materials to build this stand. So he He puts it on the tree. He affixes it to the tree. He has, according to that definition, just created a structure. So that structure then falls apart and he sustains injuries. Immunity for the landowner or no immunity for the landowner?
Yes, there still would be. In that case, it was the plaintiff who would, I guess, be injuring himself on his own structure. I don't think the plaintiff would sue himself, him or herself, but I think the definition, to your point, would qualify the plaintiff or the injured party in that case as an owner of a structure.
And that's a good answer. I don't want to lose the forest for the trees here. I see your yellow light up is on. I'm interested in hearing your response to Mr. Nur's suggestion to us, which generated a lot of discussion on both sides of the bench, that an incident, in order to enjoy immunity, must be associated with the condition of the land or the nature of the land. What is your response to that?
The statute itself doesn't limit the application in such a way, and neither do the cases. The limitations on liability are contained in 895.52 sub 2. We can look at the very general limitation, which states, and I'm paraphrasing, but that an owner is not liable for injuries sustained by a person who enters or uses property for recreational use. It doesn't link it to conditions related to the land, such as holes in the ground, rocks, trees. We also have the definition of property itself, which defines property as more than just land. It defines it as buildings and structures. So we know that the statute, by its very plain definitions, applies to more than just holes in the ground, dirt and rocks and trees.
This is Justice Prosser has a question.
If you lose on the statute, can you win on the exculpatory agreement?
Yes, I believe we can, Your Honor. The courts in both Yager and Richards enumerated really five different factors that courts should analyze these agreements on. The Yager case says a release form must have a clear title, and it must also clearly signify to the signer, the reader, the significance of what is being waived. Under those factors, the release is valid. It had a very clear title. It states at the very top that this is a waiver of liability.
But wasn't it handed to her saying, if you want to ride, you need to sign this?
Or
is that wrong?
Well, Ms. Roberts stated it was. That's how it was handed to her. There is no other indication in the record as to whether that ultimatum was made. But one of the factors that courts look at is, was there an opportunity to bargain? And I guess what the petitioner is saying, this take-it-or-leave-it kind of proposition eliminates that. But that isn't true. The agreement itself encourages questions. In Rose v. National Tractor, the Western District of Wisconsin stated that a plaintiff who had time to read and ask questions had that opportunity to bargain. That's the window.
Does the record reflect that happened, this pre-flight meeting and all that?
The pre-flight meeting, there was no pre-flight meeting. The petitioner is correct on that. But the form itself discusses the risks in ballooning. It's very specific in that sense. In that I see my red light is on. May I finish, Your Honor?
Yes.
The release form states that it applies to all activities of the ballooning that day, the takeoff, the landing, and then the flight itself. So it does clearly delineate the inherently, as the release form states, the dangerous activities that are inherent in ballooning.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. I find the Doan case a little difficult. The first part of the case says the shanty is a structure, but it says it's not on real property because it's on water, and it refuses to recognize the statutory language that says water is included under the definition here of real property. And it just says, we conclude the structures located completely on water and which are not affixed to lake bed or shore are not located on real property and therefore not themselves property. But the statute defines water as being property. Okay. So this case can be just gotten rid of right then and there, right?
Yes, I agree. Okay. Are you referring to our case, Your Honor?
Well, in this case, the Doan case can be gotten rid of right away because it's not a structure on real property. So,
under that path to ownership, yes. They're not an owner of the
not
structure.
An owner? The end. But the case goes on to say, we who were trained early in law school would say dicta, goes on to say that talks about owner and occupy. And it says, occupy is defined as to take and hold possession, citing the dictionary. That definition could imply possession for some unstated period of time, or it could be understood in a way in which time is not relevant. Could be. Therefore, reasonable persons could differ in their assessment of whether there was occupation with the shanty. But then it goes on to say, however, occupy, as used in 895-52 stats, has been defined by this court. That means this court is the Court of Appeals in Doan, has been defined by this court as requiring a degree of permanence as opposed to mere use. But there's a citation to Hall citing Smith, which is the federal case. And I gather that this is not, the degree of permanence is not in these cases. Is that right?
That phrase is not used in those cases. That's correct.
Okay. So to say that it's been defined by the Court of Appeals, not quite right.
It's been defined by the Hall case as an actual use.
Actual use, but not in terms of a degree of permanence.
Correct. If a degree of permanence is read to mean something greater than actual use, then I would say that's
the first
not
time it comes up is in Doan?
The phrase degree, yes, that's correct.
Out of no other case law.
Not by a Wisconsin court, no. Right. I don't know if there's an opinion out there from another state that...
No, but or the federal courts in Wisconsin which have interpreted the statute.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
The way I look at this particular case is... The struggle with degree of permanence, whether they're an owner, is an occupier, is a user, requires a degree of permanence. What is that degree of permanence? Is it hours in this? Could it be hours in this situation? Is it days in other situations? In our particular case, I say that issue can be eliminated and not addressed by this court for one simple reason, because in Koski and in Linville, this court made it very clear, and the Court of Appeals made it very clear, that the intent of this statute is to apply only to conditions of the land or maintenance of the land. It is not intended to apply to negligent acts unassociated with the condition of the land or maintenance of the land. And I would argue here, in this case, what happened that day has absolutely nothing to do with the condition of the land, and holding them liable and responsible is not going to thwart the true intent of this statute, which is to private landowners to open up their land.
Well, yes. Let's look at the statute and your assertion that it has to be tied to the condition of the land. The statute itself, 895-52, defines recreational activity. And it specifically lists, the legislature specifically lists ballooning as a recreational activity. Now, my sense is ballooning is done in the air.
Correct.
And so I give some moment to the fact that the legislature, in defining recreational activity, specifically lists an activity that, of course, can, you know, does often start on the land, a particular particular land.
Correct.
But primarily is in the air. So how do you get around that specific choice of the legislature to give us an airborne activity?
Well, I get around it in this way. I look at it as if we don't interpret it my way and we don't interpret it in the Linville way and the Koski way, then what's the purpose of 895.525, which is another recreational, not immunity statute, but it's participation in a recreational event where they, again, specifically list ballooning as a recreational activity, where if you participate in that under 895.525, you're accepting the risks that go along with that.
Participating, I mean, under this recreational immunity statute, we have defined it as not just participating, but spectators also, right? So
correct.
It's a broader definition than just participation.
That is correct, but if you take a look at 525, they define everything exactly the same way as they do in 895.52. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to interpret 895.52 the way they want it interpreted, why do we even need 895.525?
This statute came out 20 years ago or so, and we had a plethora, but let me say just a heck of a lot of cases in 95, 96, 97, as referenced earlier. I mean, a lot of them dealt with, I remember fondly, Central Wisconsin, you know, one of the early ones dealt with Mosinee Papers and Stevens Point, walking on a boardwalk. And I remember talking about humming Dixie. If you're humming Dixie as you're walking on the boardwalk, is it a recreational activity? Because that's the question of on a boardwalk through a park, was that a recreational activity? And did you have to be enjoying it? Those facts, they were going on an errand, so it wasn't so much of a joy, you know. So, I mean, and in the earlier days of interpretation, this court, in my opinion, was pretty dogmatic to look. The legislature has said there is, we want this liberally construed to protect the landowner. We want to make sure that there is no duty to keep the property safe for recreational activities. That's in sub 2. The landowner has no duty to warn specifically, has no duty to inspect. You can be as negligent as you want to be, landowner, and that's the way we interpreted it. Because that's what the statute said. So why should we now be changing our focus of interpretation?
The red light is on you. Wish me to
continue. Answer your question.
I want you to reinstate Patty Roberts and Dave Roberts' claim because doing so does not impact or alter the original intent of this statute as stated by this court and as stated by the legislature. The phrase you kept using is landowner. Landowner, landowner. This statute was entitled, to protect landowners or the lessees that have the ability to give permission to somebody to come on their land. Finding Sundog negligent for proceeding with a tethered event in the face of an oncoming storm front will not in any way squelch or ice or anything private landowners' decisions to open up their land.
But you're ignoring the rest of the statute. Sure, it's landowners. Sure, it's lessees. But it's also occupiers. That's why we're in part here today. You can't erase that. Those are the words of the legislature.
I can't argue with that, but that takes us back to what did the legislature really mean by occupier, and what did this court mean in Doan? And there was a term permanency. If you go back to the Seventh Circuit case of
Smith?
Yes.
Cited the New Jersey Superior Court.
They actually, they're the ones who, as I say, it says occupier is something more than it says it can be use, but they also use the term permanence. And they, after analyzing all the facts with regard to the snowmobile trail and the control that the snowmobile club exercised over the trail. They constructed it. They maintained it. They staked it. They had signs. They had all that.
Smith was 1987, if I remember
correct.
Correctly. Predates
the statute. But that court also specifically addressed that there has to be a degree of permanence, and they said, taking a look at the conduct of the snowmobiling, the two snowmobiling clubs, there's a degree of permanence associated with the maintenance of these trails because it goes over the entire winter. But I also understand that, you know, I don't like it, but it's almost like dancing on the head of a pin with regard to, well, what is enough use or to make a certain modicum of permanence that you're now entitled to the immunity of a landowner? And that's where I'm having problems, folks, is the immunity, like you say, three removed, doing nothing that has anything to do with the land at all, other than being there, is now being provided immunity under this statute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very, very good and spirited arguments on an interesting question. We're going to take a brief adjournment.